I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. As lifelong Disney fans, the work of countless talented Disney creatives have shaped our lives.
Now, as the Disney catalog expands, we're taking a journey through film and television to discover if that spark that shaped us as children lives on in adulthood.
Does your favorite Disney media still cast that same spell? Join us as we find out. We are
Rewatching the Magic. Happy birthday, Kiki!
Happy birthday, Tuesday!
Happy birthday, podcast!
Woohoo!
Today is the one-year anniversary, the first birthday of our child, Kiki. This podcast, our baby.
It's the only one I'm ever going to have.
1 year ago, honestly, on the day we are recording, and that I found this out moments before we recorded, was the day that we sat down and decided we're going to record a podcast and recorded our first episode, which was The Little Mermaid.
We were and so much younger then.
2020 hadn't happened yet, and we've all aged about a decade in the last year.
But you know what? Let's forget about that, because today is a happy day.
Happy day, happy anniversary, happy birthday. Yeah, 1 year ago, two nerds decided, hey, we're going to do a Disney podcast, and we made a Disney podcast.
We did not think we were going to make it to a year.
No.
We'd fizzle out in a couple of months, to be honest.
I thought we would fizzle out after we finished up the Renaissance.
Yeah, but we're still here, and if you're still here with us and listening to this, bless you so much.
Yeah, whether you started out with us in the early days or found us over the summer, as a lot of our listeners have, thank you for listening to us. Thank you for sticking around with us, and we hope that we've brought you some enjoyment. Thank you for joining us. But before we get into the merriment, we do have something that we want to talk about. Kiki, do you want to get our news story of the week?
Well, you know, we've always said on this show that we don't stan a corporation.
No.
We love the creatives who work for Disney, but Disney as a corporation sometimes makes an oopsie doodle, and when they do, we feel compelled to call it out. And Disney has made a massive oopsie doodle. So when Disney bought the Star Wars franchise from Lucasfilm, when Disney bought Fox, when they went through the merger with Fox, they inherited a lot more than just films and television. Star Wars in particular had a robust tie-in fiction market. They threw away some of it, but you know, it's no longer canon, but they didn't throw the entire baby out with the bathwater. But they, you know, Star Wars has a lot of novels, tie-in fiction attached to it, but also some of the Fox things like Aliens and other properties will also have novelizations and tie-in fiction with that. Well, Disney has decided that at least one of the authors of those books doesn't deserve to be paid. Author Alan Dean Foster, who, if you ever read any sort of science fiction or especially tie-in fiction, you will recognize that name immediately. He has written a lot of Star Wars fiction, a lot of Alien fiction. He even ghost wrote the novelization of the first Star Wars film under George Lucas's name. They attributed it to George Lucas, but Alan Dean Foster was the man who actually sat down and wrote that novelization for what we now call A New Hope. Disney bought the rights to publish those books and everything, but Disney is now claiming that they did not buy the responsibility to pay the author the royalties he is due under his original contract. So they are refusing to pay him royalties for further sales of the books after Disney took over. He has gone to is, I don't know if it's a union, but the Science Fiction Writers of America, they're typically an intermediary that handles these sort of disputes between publishers and authors. They are handling some things for him. They are advertising kind of what's going on with him. And he says that, unfortunately, it has come to the shaming a giant corporation in public part of this deal, because Disney is refusing to sit down to arbitration without a lot of stipulations attached. They're just, yeah. But their claim is that we bought the rights to profit off of these things, but we did not buy the rights to, or the responsibilities to pay the royalties owed for the creation. I absolutely know that some of the other entertainment unions would not stand for this. Like, there would be strikes if they tried to do this to Screen Actors Guild or Directors Guild of America, for instance.
Yeah.
But while authors have been trying to unionize and collectivize a bit more, and there are several good groups, one at least I know of specifically that works with writers of tie-in fiction, it's not as robust as some of the other entertainment unions. So Disney seems to feel like that they can kick around the little guy on this one. Alan Dean Foster, for his part, is currently battling a rather aggressive cancer. His wife is also very ill, and this was a primary source of income for him, these royalties, because these books are constantly in reprint and constantly being sold. So for that to suddenly dry up is a great hardship for him, I'm sure. His fans and several of his fellow authors have taken to the internet to try to, you know, once again, use the internet to shame a giant corporation into doing the right thing. But we'll see what happens with that. We are continuing to monitor the story, and hopefully Disney will do the right thing.
Hopefully. I mean, they own these franchises. They own Star Wars. They own Alien. They own all of these things because, you know, they bought Lucasfilm. They bought Fox. This is their property, and they have that responsibility to take care of the people that have worked on these properties. We've already complained about the massive firing within their parks. And yeah, that was wrong then. It still is. And those people should. Disney is a big enough corporation that they can still pay these people with what they're making right now. But as we've kind of talked about, it seems they're more interested in paying their executives than paying their people.
Yeah, it's true. And unfortunately, if this is allowed to stand, if Disney is allowed to get away with this, this suddenly means that maybe Paramount doesn't have to pay out for all those Star Trek books that have been written.
And Warner
maybe
may
Blizzard
not have...
doesn't have to pay out for all the Warcraft novels that are out there.
Warner,
you know,
doesn't have to pay for all the DC novels.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really bad precedent to set, and I hope if this ever makes it to a judge that the judge laughs this out of court, because this is ridiculous.
Yeah. So hashtag Disney must pay. That is the official stance of this podcast.
Pay your workers. That is the official stance of this podcast. Pay your workers.
Pay them a fair wage. Let's add down that. And so yeah, that is our official statement on that story. And if anything comes from that story, we will bring it to you. But now let's get back to the 1 year celebration of this podcast. So it took us a while to decide, what are we going to do for the 1 year mark of this podcast? It sure is not going to be the Star Wars holiday special. But we are going to.
So we moved that to last week.
Yeah. So we are going to stay within the realm of Lucasfilm, stay with a franchise that Disney does own. And I'm pretty sure they technically do own this movie. But it's not on Disney Plus. We went to Netflix, which is not the first time we've done that for this podcast. So what movie would work best to represent not only what this podcast is about, but us personally? So we decided to go all the way back to the beginning, at least for us, the year that we were both born, 1981, showing our age. Me and Kiki are very close in age, only born about a month apart. So 81 was like a huge year for movies in itself. And especially the big year for Lucasfilm, as the year prior, Empire Strikes Back came out. And that was huge. And
yeah, Empire took Star Wars from a flash in the pan one-off movie to now this is a franchise.
A franchise that still exists.
Yeah, and a franchise that they felt comfortable leaving on a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Which at that time was not done in film.
Especially
like
when
you don't
next
leave your film on a cliffhanger.
Especially when the next movie wouldn't be out for another 4 years. At least when Marvel does it, they say the sequel will be out next year.
Yeah, they've already been filming that sequel by the time this movie comes out. Yeah. Yeah, so that was a big risk for Lucasfilm.
It paid off in the end.
It did, but at the time, people were very skeptical. The movie we're talking about today was another big risk for Lucasfilm.
Yeah, we are talking about Raiders of the Lost Ark, the biggest movie of 1981, taglined as The Return of the Great Adventure, as this was going to be sort of a throwback to those World War II serials that George Lucas himself was a big fan of, and was part of the inspiration for Star Wars to begin with, those serials that he would go to the theater every week to see.
Yeah, and we've talked about serial films before when we were talking about like Zorro and stuff, and also with Star Wars, the kind of, you know, adventuring archetype that Indiana Jones is based on were also very strong through some of those things. You had the kind of spaceship serials. You had some that were more military based.
Mm-hmm.
You had a lot that were like Superman and the superhero kind of serials.
Mm-hmm.
But you also had the kind of generic adventure serials.
Mm-hmm. And again, especially during the 1940s, where all of these were conveniently fighting the Nazis. Like, you know.
Yeah, a lot of them were put out as war propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
And all across the board, there's a lot of like old Superman fights the Nazis serials that are out there. You know, I mean, they exist and they're fascinating. Mm-hmm.
Disney was not innocent of it either, even having Donald Duck fight the Nazis.
Oh yeah. Also, we may get into some of the Disney propaganda of the 40s at some point, but yeah. I think it's fascinating that George Lucas really wanted to do a Flash Gordon film. But he couldn't get the rights because the rights had been sold to somebody else.
So he decided, I'm going to make my own Flash Gordon with black suited monsters and laser swords.
Yeah. But he also had been toying around with a new character that he had called Indiana Smith, who was going to be named after his dog and be an adventurer in the style of these old serials.
Mm-hmm.
And those kind of two things, those two ideas in his head kind of, you know, dovetailed and gave him the idea of like, well, if I can't do Flash Gordon, but I do want to make a movie that kind of brings back the feel of those old serials, what about this other character I've been working on?
Really, the success of the first Star Wars pretty much gave Lucas carte blanche to do whatever he wanted in Hollywood.
Yeah, and when he was looking for a partner to do this, because let's face it, George Lucas, really good idea guy. He's excellent. We talked about this in Star Wars. Excellent in stories and characters, world building. Not as good a director.
Yeah, the famous quote from Harrison Ford when working on the first Star Wars movie was, "What's my direct?" He's asking George, "What's my direction in this scene? What do you want me to do?" Lucas just gave him the script, said, "Here are the words, say them."
Yeah, not how you direct a film, gang. Just in case you didn't know, that's not it. So he got his buddy, one of his best friends, actually, who had just hit it big shortly before Star Wars with his kind of big debut splash, pun intended, of a movie, Jaws. And he called up Steven Spielberg and said, "Hey, you also like the same nerdy stuff I like. What if we work together?" But you gotta remember that both Lucas and Spielberg were new to the game at this point as far as becoming household names.
Yeah, they weren't the legends they are now. Not yet.
By the time Indiana Jones came out, we'd have, from Spielberg, we'd have Jaws, we'd have Close Encounters of the Third Kind, George Lucas already had Star Wars, in there. He had American Graffiti too, but that made less of a splash culturally. And so this was the new hotness in Hollywood, and they've just announced they're going to team up to bring back a concept from the 40s that not a lot of people really remembered. Yeah. But we're going to make it cool for the new generation.
And they make the choice of keeping it in that 1940s era.
Yeah, but this would be kind of Spielberg's first foray into something that he would later win an Oscar for, which is, hey, weren't the Nazis awful people? Because I think that the stroke of genius in this film was making the Nazis the bad guys. He wasn't just out there looking for some MacGuffin. He's out there fighting Nazis. This is yet another one of those films that we're going to talk about that I think probably shouldn't have worked.
On paper, yeah, but in practice, it's still considered to this day not only one of the greatest films of the 80s, but one of the greatest films of all time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this film is legendary. Everybody knows it. Even before I watched this film as a kid, I knew about it. I mean, I technically wasn't born until after this film came out. I think you were born before it came out.
No, this is June. I was July.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So neither of us have even breathed in a world without Indiana Jones. Let's just face it. This movie was so massive that it took me a while. We've talked about that before. It took me a while to be able to see films, especially like, what's this one? A PG-13, I think.
One of the first.
Film, yeah. So it's one of those things that I wasn't allowed to watch this as like a really young kid, but references to this film were everywhere. Muppet Babies did a huge, I mean, it's even in the title credits.
Yeah.
Of Kermit dressed as Indiana Jones and stuff. So by the time I saw the film fully, it was like, I already knew every part of this film. It was just, I was so baked in a culture that loved this film.
That's what, I mean, a good example, a movie that you and I have seen many, many times, Weird Al's UHF. The opening scene is a straight parody of the opening scene to Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, and not made that long after. I mean, mm-mm. And that's also an 80s film. But if you had just said, hey, we've got a couple of sci-fi guys, and now they want to do 1940s adventurer. Again, on paper, I don't think this should work. But it just does.
And it's, to me, the reason it works is four parts. We've talked about two of them, George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. The third part would be John Williams, that score. We talked about John Williams before, working like with Star Wars and Back to the Future. And then you have what this movie wouldn't be what it is without Harrison Ford.
Yeah. And Harrison, we talked about it when we talked about Star Wars. Like, Harrison Ford was not really intending to be an actor, I don't think.
He was a carpenter.
Yeah.
But he made such a splash in the first Star Wars movie that everyone wanted him. I mean, after this movie, after being seen in Raiders, this movie, Raiders, got him the part in Blade Runner. And since then, it's just been strap the rocket, send him to the moon.
Yeah. Star Wars may have really kind of launched his career, but this is what cemented it.
Yeah. And also, it was Raiders itself was kind of the reason why Harrison Ford wanted Han Solo killed off in Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, he wanted to focus on other things. He didn't want to be beholden to coming back to...
He didn't want to be known for one role.
Yeah.
He was right. I mean, to this day, no matter how many roles he'll take... Mark Hamill will always be known as Luke Skywalker.
Yeah. But Harrison Ford kind of partially escaped that. He will be known as Han Solo, of course, but he'll also be known as Indiana Jones. He'll also be known, you know, I mean, he's known for more than one thing.
Mm-hmm.
So probably good move for them.
So we've already talked about Harrison Ford. Let's talk about some of the other people in this movie. So obviously another person, John Rhys Davies, as kind of the sidekick, Sala, a Welsh man playing an Egyptian man. Yeah.
But you know what? He does it really well, so I don't know.
John Rhys Davies is one of my favorite actors. Yes, he was Gimli in Lord of the Rings. I will always know him as Professor Arturo in Sliders.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And, of course, he was Macbeth in Gargoyles.
Yeah. Actually, John Rhys Davies being in the commercials for Sliders was what made me watch Sliders.
Mm.
Like, I saw him in the commercial and I was like, it's Sala! Yeah! I'll watch that. I'll give that a few episodes. And to this day, I still love Sliders. Good show. Cheesy at points, but, you know, what 90s sci-fi wasn't. He, you know, incredible actor. As we all know now, I think now he's kind of, people respect him more. But, you know, at the time, not a huge name. That's the interesting thing is that a lot of the people involved in at least the first movie were not like the biggest names.
Mm-hmm.
They had careers. They were known. I'm not saying that they were all unknown nobodies, but they weren't like super household names.
I mean, let's take a look at Karen Allen, who plays Marion, the love interest. I mean, she was only really known from doing Animal House at the time.
Yeah. A movie I have never seen, to be honest. So I understand that she is in it. A friend of mine told me that it is his personal headcanon that Marion is her character from Animal House, but just grown up.
So. Even though that was in the '80s, was it in the '80s or was it the family 70s? That was 70s.
78. Yeah.
Yeah, and this is in 1939, but sure, whatever.
Yeah. So yeah, once again, somebody that you would probably be like, oh, hey, that girl, you know, if you had seen Animal House, especially, but not really the biggest household name, in Karen Allen.
I will always know her as playing Claire in Scrooge with Bill Murray.
also in, Starman with Jeff Bridges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it. She's just that girl. If you need a love interest, call Karen Allen.
Yeah, Karen Allen, serviceable love interest. kind of the other recurring one that we get is Denholm Elliott, who played Marcus Brody, who's Indy's boss at the university there.
Yeah.
He had a bit more established career as an actor than most of them in this film. He was already known for parts in Alfie by this point, which was a massive hit film. But once again, a lot of the big roles you'd know him for kind of came after Indiana Jones. So he probably had kind of the most known name, I guess. But even still, this movie was like, hey, you're that guy that was in Indiana Jones. So, yeah.
Yeah.
and they all kind of were like that. A bit. Let's move on to kind of, I guess, the plot.
Sure.
Of the film.
Yeah, there's a lot of there's a story here. So we got 1936, and we have our archaeologist Indiana Jones going on this mission to grab this idol in Peru with this small group of explorers. And he's always been told, all they know is that no one's ever come out of this cave alive, and the locals aren't very happy that people are trespassing on their land. The group he's with aren't the most trustworthy of people, as at the first opportunity, they're all turning on poor Indy. They all end up dead after turning on Indy, but yeah.
Those two things are kind of unrelated.
Yeah. Mostly because Indy knows how to get around the traps in these temples and they don't.
The interesting thing, this is what has always bothered me. Because when Indy first, he goes to set foot in the temple, and at this point, it is just him and Satipa.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, by the way, that was Alfred Molina's first on-screen role, at least in a feature film. I think he might have done television before, but yeah, that basically launched his career as well. So Indy and Satipo are the only two that make it to the mouth of the temple, the entrance to the temple.
Everyone and Satipo else says,
yeah, everybody else has died or run away. And Satipo says, as Indy is gathering sand into a bag for the idol swap later, he says, no one has ever come out of this temple alive. Which begs the question to me, how the absolute crap does Indiana Jones know every single trap in
Well, it's implied that this is not his first rodeo, and even as I know, you know, he's done this before. So trial and error, I suppose, of other temples and sites that he's gone to, that there's booby traps.
He knows that there is going to be a pressure sensor weight triggered thing at the, because he is filling that bag with sand before he walks in. Mm-hmm. He already knows that that's what's at the end of this temple maze, you know. If nobody has ever left to tell, you know, I mean, maybe whatever tribe set this temple up had like really extensive writings, but also doesn't that negate the point of a trapped, you know, like if you're setting up like a bank and you install a bunch of like trip wires and, you know, laser sensors and stuff like that, you're not going to publish that in the newspaper. Like, by the way,
yeah,
take 2 steps and turn left and take 4 steps and turn right. You know, it's like, but Indy seems to know exactly what's coming at every step of the way.
And even that's kind of become a trope in adventure movies, especially one with treasure, where it's like there's a dedicated map telling you exactly where to go to avoid traps.
Yeah, and I just don't see it happening. I mean, this entire culture seems to have been built on protect this idol. Because honestly, for what the amount of, like, you know, manpower and other stuff that they put into building that temple, they probably could have bought 100 of those idols. Like, you know?
Yeah.
It seems like far too much to be protecting that thing.
Yeah, and Indy does mention a colleague of his that was the last person to have been seen going into the temple, and we see the outcome of said colleague as he's impaled on one of the traps. The
traps. Yeah, he's hanging out on the spikes there. But I mean, it sets up Indy as awesome. Yeah. You know, he seems very in control through most of it. But
it also makes everyone else that's with him
thinking about it.
Yeah, it really makes everyone else that's with him complete idiots.
Yeah, and I get that they wanted to show the difference. You know, here is our cool, suave hero, and here are, you know, the lesser people that have come with him.
They used Indy's trademark whip to go over a chasm, and then we get the trademark scene of this movie, the scene everybody knows, the scene that has been parodied in every TV show and movie in the 80s, the famous Golden Idol scene.
Yeah. Taking out a little bit of sand, trying to gauge the exact weight. Not quite getting it right.
I always wondered if Indy had not taken any sand out of the bag, that would it have worked, or would it still have gone down?
I think he probably still had too much sand in the bag, because people really overestimate how heavy gold is. Mm. Like, unless something is absolute solid gold, but even like a full gold bar is not as heavy as you would think it is. Gold is a rather light material. So he probably sees this thing and is like, well, obviously it is made of pure gold. That's got to weigh a ton, but probably not. And also maybe it's just gold plated rather than gold all the way through. And it might be like, you know, gold plated pottery or something. We don't know what's on the inside of that thing. So I think he probably overestimated the weight, if anything. I kind of want to talk about the open in as a whole, because this is one of the best openings to a film in history.
And it tells you everything you need to know about what's going to happen in the rest of the film, in the rest of the movie. It tells you everything you need to know about Indy. It tells you everything you know about Belloc.
By the time it fades to black on Indy in the plane screaming about a snake,
Yeah, the setup of his fear of snakes.
You have everything you need to know about this man to know whether or not you are down for the ride that is this movie.
Yeah, I mean, and that's all in the first 10 minutes of this film.
And it's, yeah, it is an amazing act one.
Yeah.
You know?
The line that sticks with me, and it's repeated a few times in the movie, is Belloc always saying, there's nothing you can have that I won't eventually take away. And that,
yeah,
that rings so much true with almost everyone, especially in 2020. It's like, there's always to be someone that will always take something that belongs to you after you worked hard for it. And that, yeah, that just resonated so much. Maybe it's me, but it just resonated, that one line resonated so much with me as it will for the first time in a long time seeing this movie.
Yeah, and I think that it's also a bit of a kick to the nethers that Belloc doesn't actually care about the objects.
No, he just wants the money, really.
He just wants the money. You know, at least Indy does have, you know, while his methods may be a little suspect, he does actually care about the academic interest in this, the research part of this, the understanding ancient human cultures better.
And we see that as we see Indy as a teacher, as a college professor.
Yeah, you want to talk about whiplash? This movie, going the first time I watched this, I don't think I actually understood that Indiana Jones was a professor. You know, that's not really a part that is talked about in all the parodies. So I had seen all these parodies and I was like, okay, I know what Indiana Jones is about. He's a tomb raider with a whip and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Okay. And then I watched the movie for the first time as a kid. And it goes from, like, him being, like, super awesome stunt guy. And then he's, like, nerdy college professor talking about, you know, digs in Egypt and stuff. And I was like, this is not the same man.
Yeah.
This is Harrison Ford playing his twin brother, Omaha Jones or something, you know?
I want to talk about that classroom scene, because we get that establishing shot of most of his students are women, but none of them are paying attention to the lesson. They're just ogling Harrison Ford. One of the young girls in the class actually has the words "I love you" written across her eyelids. Yeah.
Here's the thing. I was kind of discussing this with a friend during the rewatch, where I was like, okay, now, women are the majority of college students. There are more women in college than there are men. In 1936, yes, there were some women in colleges, but not that many. You know, you might have one or two women in a class. And I'm not talking about in a classroom. I'm talking about, like, in a graduating year. You know, you'd have a few women. And then also, this cannot be like a a basic class that everybody has to take.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not one of your core curriculum that everybody takes before they go off to their majors. Like, this seems to be a rather advanced archaeology major class that he's teaching. And 99% of the students are women. And I know that that's a joke of, like, hey, isn't Harrison Ford hot? But it's just so unrealistic to the time. Like, is every woman in this town specifically entering college just to take this one class in a major they don't care about just to get in the room with Indiana Jones?
Harrison Ford's a good-looking dude. Let's not lie about this, especially young Harrison Ford in 1981. Good-looking dude. But it's like this... So, women... wanting to be in the same place as Harrison Ford, the person, just to ogle him, I understand that. But the message of this classroom being mostly women because they think the teacher's hot.
Yeah, not a super good look.
And even makes the character argument. Yeah, even makes Indiana himself uncomfortable. Like, he starts stumbling his words and screwing the lesson up because he doesn't like the idea that his female students are trying to flirt with him.
Yeah, you get the sense that when he's off on an adventure, he's kind of a little more free, but that when he's in his role as a professor, he tries to keep it
professional.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think Indiana Jones has ever had any kind of illicit relationships with any of his female students, but on his adventure, that's a different story.
Well, given what happened with Marion, I wouldn't be so sure.
Eh.
We'll get to that.
I don't think she was one of his students, though.
No, she wasn't. She was the daughter of his professor, but I mean, maybe he learned his lesson after that, but there's some stuff there.
Yeah.
We'll get there. Just a second.
So, yeah, now we get to the point where we get that several people from the government want to talk to Dr. Jones here. Yes, we had him. He's a doctor. The Nazis are going after the Ark of the Covenant, which according to this movie, holds the Ten Commandments, the original slabs of stone that God told Moses to write the Ten Commandments on. And it's very convenient that Indiana Jones knows so much about the Ark of the Covenant. Like, he just happens to be carrying a book that has a picture of the Ark on it. He knows about how to find where it is with the medallion that's needed to find it and everything. It's awfully convenient. Granted, Expedition Dump needs to go somewhere, but it's a little too convenient for me.
Yeah, but this is not a, even as a child watching this, they were like, yeah, the Nazis are searching for the Ark of the Covenant. And I was immediately like, oh my goodness, the Ark that in the Old Testament is said to contain the tablets of the Ten Commandments. And in the New Testament, it said that they also added the staff of Aaron and, some of the manna from the walk in the wilderness and stuff like, because I was a church kid. And to be honest, a lot of this stuff is kind of just lifted straight from actual stories in the Talmud and the Bible.
Between this movie and Last Crusade, there's a lot of Christian lore involved.
Yeah, but the thing is that it is kind of accurate to what Hitler did try to do.
And it's
He was very, very much interested in trying to find actual physical manifestations of mystical power.
To make his army more powerful. Give him the power of God.
Some of those, he didn't seem to really care which God, because it is known that he was trying to find out if there were actually artifacts from, ancient Jewish traditions, Christian traditions. He had people, trying out magical rituals to see if they worked from all kinds of cultures. Hitler was like really into this stuff. Like, I cannot explain to you how much Hitler was like, if there is magic or psychics or some little doodad that is going to give me mystical power, we are going to find it. And one of the reasons that the Nazis may have not succeeded is because they put a lot of effort into chasing all this mystical stuff and not as much into, like, studying the battle plans and the making of, you know, weapons of war and stuff. Like, it really did kind of split their focus a little bit and may have contributed to their downfall. But so this is not coming out of nowhere, this idea that Hitler is funding a massive dig in Egypt to try to find an object which may or may not exist, you know? Even if you believe the stories of the Bible, there are a lot of people who believe that these objects are not on Earth anymore. You know, that they may have been taken back to heaven, or that, you know, they have been removed from humanity in some way to prevent their misuse. So it's like, you know, it's interesting to see that this film kind of understands enough about what the Nazis were doing to realize that, yeah, they would sink a lot of manpower into basically a wild goose chase at this point.
But this movie does take that seriously. Like, this is stuff that, in as far as this movie is concerned, is real and does exist. So there is a bit of magic and mysticism in these movies. So it's not completely factually based. There's, you know, a little bit of fantasy in there. And yeah, Indy is all in on
this. And eventually, like, aliens.
We don't talk about that one. That one doesn't exist. We don't
talk about the aliens.
Indiana Jones did not survive a nuclear explosion by being in a refrigerator.
Oh.
And the fact that Disney wants to make another one.
You know.
Anyway. yeah, Indy is all in on this. You know, he's like, that night he's packing his suitcase, getting ready to go to Cairo.
Nepal. Because he's got to hunt down Marion, the daughter of his former professor. And his former professor was the absolute authority on Ark of the Covenant and things related to it. But he has mysteriously gone missing. So we got to go to his only living relative, his daughter, who apparently runs a bar in Nepal.
I have to say, another trope in other adventure movies. Granted, it's a trope that Spielberg took from the old serials, but other movies have used it kind of in reference to Raiders, is the map traveling.
Yeah.
Where you just see a plane take off and then just this map of a directional line from one point to another point.
There's a joke in one of the Muppet movies, isn't there, where they said we're going to travel by map?
Yeah.
And that they do this. But.
So yeah, we end up in Nepal.
Yeah, I really like that map bit. Because it really does make it feel like you're watching an older movie than you are.
Yeah.
So I do like that throwback.
So we meet Marion, and she's in the bar, and it's established that she can drink any man under the table. Granted, she likes to have a little bit of theatrics with it to make it look like she can't hold her liquor, but at the end, she's just taking those shots like a pro, and no one can take her on in a drinking contest.
The interesting thing is that we do see at the beginning that she kind of does, like, she looks like she's going to be sick. She looks like she's going to pass out. People start exchanging money, like, oh, she lost the drinking battle. And then she tells them to stop. And then she kind of slowly puts the glass down on the table. But the thing is that immediately after the bar clears, when Indiana Jones walks in, she is absolutely clear-headed.
Yeah. Again, this is a nice setup of her character.
Yeah.
Especially with what happens later in the film.
Once again, this film is brilliant about character setup. You know, 5 minutes with a character and you know everything about them, which I love.
Mm-hmm. So the bar's closed, you know, last call, as it were. And Indy comes in and pretty much is willing to throw down thousands of dollars for this medallion that he remembers Marion's father used to have, and it might be the key to finding the Ark of the Covenant.
And remember, this is thousands of dollars in 1936 money, so he's probably dropping like half a mil given inflation.
Yeah. And she kind of doesn't want to be any part of it, because as soon as she meets Indy, she socks him in the face. You deserve that, Indy.
Oh, boy, does he really deserve that.
So what we know is that these two were involved 10 years ago, and Indy kind of walked out on her. Ghosted her, as it were.
Yeah.
And she's kind of held that pain for 10 years. And he only comes back into her life because he needs something. Everyone knows that one person. That one person that just wants nothing to do with you until you have something that they want.
Yep. But let's talk about the thing that's not super said here. There is a backstory here that mostly got cut, and it only survives to the finished movie in one line. She screams, "I was a child." And he said, "You knew what you were doing." And she said, "No, I didn't." They meant that literally. Is that the backstory?
He took her innocence,
was,
pretty much.
Well, the backstory was supposed to be that he was a college student who was under the mentorship of her father and therefore hanging around the house a lot. Mm-hmm. It is suggested that she, as a young teen, I've heard people say she was supposed to be maybe 15. I've heard people say that she maybe was supposed to have been younger than that. But basically... She sees hot Harrison Ford, who is quite a few years older than her. She is probably at least what we would now consider underage. I don't really know what it was like in 1936 in most of America. And she gets a little crush on him. He takes advantage of that. And then he's like, "Okay, I'm graduated and off to do whatever I'm going to do," and just leaves her there. But this is kind of the point of Marion's, a lot of her issue here. She was desperately in love with him as a child. He took advantage of that, which is why I'm wondering, like, the scene with him and the students, you know? Like,
yeah, maybe
is he really all that uncomfortable, or does he have a history?
Maybe maybe he just had that one relationship. Like, yeah, we're not doing this again. That was not.
Yeah, it might have been like a mistake that he decided never to repeat. But he's very defensive about it when she brings it up. So it kind of makes me think of like maybe he hasn't learned his lesson, because he never really apologizes to her.
Yeah. So
make of that what you will. Again. Different time, it probably wouldn't have been, you know, illegal or anything in 1936. It wouldn't have been, you know, there's a gray area there.
So she decides that she's going to consider the proposal of the $5,000 that he's going to pay her for this medallion. Excuse me. Pretty much says, "Come back tomorrow and I'll think about it." And she's holding, I mean, she's already been paid. Because she's holding the money in her hand. And then she just reaches into her shirt and takes out the medallion that Indies has been looking for, and kind of looks at it, looks at the money, kind of judging it. Essentially, the last thing she has of her father is this medallion. Because it's been explained that her father's dead. We don't know how long, but he's dead. So
yeah, she tells him he's not missing, he's dead. And that's kind of the end of that story. Did he, like, have a heart attack? Was he murdered by Nazis? We never quite find out what exactly happened to Abner Ravenwood.
And the only thing she has of her father is the medallion and the bar.
Yeah.
We assume that he ran the bar at some point, or at least bought the bar for her.
Yeah, I don't know how she ended up running this bar, actually. It's never kind of explicitly said.
She does say, this is mine now, though. So it's maybe possible that her father ran the bar and then she inherited it when he died.
Who knows?
Who knows? Anyway.
But as soon as Indy leaves, Nazis show up because Nazis.
Yep.
And instead of, you know, trying to talk to her, pay her, bribe her, or use her hatred of Indiana Jones against her, they do what Nazis do best and just decide to threaten her with violence and torture.
And luckily, before anything can go down, Indy comes back and we have this great action fight scene with shootings and things get set on fire, and it's a really great scene that you can't really put into words.
I do love that during this fight, somebody shoots a barrel of liquor that's sitting on the bar, and Marion takes a second out of the fight to just drink from the liquor that's pouring out of the.
You don't want good booze to go to waste.
That's true, but given also how much she has already had that night, we know it was enough liquor to absolutely lay waste to a very large Nepalese man.
This woman can hold her liquor.
So, yeah, I do not think Marion actually suffers from drunkenness. Like, I'm not sure she can get intoxicated.
Very, very high tolerance.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a nice scene where kind of evens out in a way where one of these men tries to go after Marion, and then you just see this big old hole in his head as Indy gets shot in from behind. And later in the scene, Marion kind of returns the favor by shooting another guy that's about to kill Indy in the back.
Yeah.
It's a nice little scene between the two. And it shows that Marion can take care of herself. She's very skilled with a firearm. Granted,
yeah,
she's not the best fighter.
She's not as skilled as Indy is at hand-to-hand combat, but she doesn't shirk away from it.
Yeah.
She's not a screaming damsel in distress. She holds her own fight.
That's Temple of Doom?
You know what? I got thoughts about Willie, so let's save those for another day.
So anyway, as the fire rages on in the bar, the medallion ends up falling into this little part that's set on fire. And anyone who's had any kind of metal near any kind of
heat source,
even if the metal isn't directly in the fire, it conducts heat. And the Nazi man, Mr. Tort here, tries to grab it with its bare hand and scorches his hand on the hot metal.
Yep. Drops the medallion back into the fire.
That does come
because Nazis are stupid enough to try to grab hot metal from a fire.
At least Marion is skilled enough to grab a handkerchief and pick up the medallion. I don't think that would have helped her much, but it's at least her thinking about, you know, I don't think she had an oven mitt handy or anything, you know?
Well, and also she doesn't grab it by the actual medallion part. She grabs it by the chain.
Mm-hmm.
Which would be a smaller source of heat. Mm. I mean, it would still be hot. She would still need the handkerchief, but it wouldn't conduct or trap as much heat as the actual, you know, solid medallion would.
So yeah, the bar has been burned to the ground, and the Nazis have fled. And Marion is pretty much saying, until you pay me the entire amount that you owe me, as India's only paid her part of the amount, as long as I have the medallion and you owe me money, we're partners in this mission, whether you like it or not. And she has a point.
Well, also, I think now it's less you owe me the money for the medallion and more you owe me the money for the bar.
Yeah.
I mean, part of that was on the Nazis, but, you know, Indy was kind of not really gentle with it. It's technically Indy who set the bar on fire. Because it was him doing the whip and causing the poker to fall over. Yeah. Anyway.
So now they're in Cairo.
Yeah, now we're in Egypt, and there is Sala, the best character in this movie.
Arguably one of the best characters in this franchise.
Yeah, easily so, I'd say. He is just such a joyful man.
And obviously,
he's got his wife, he's got like 17 children, he seems happy with it all, he's happy to see his friend, he's happy to see Marion.
So
like,
yeah,
this is just a man full of joy. I love him.
And a monkey.
Well, it's not his monkey.
Yeah, they are wondering where this monkey come from. We've never seen this monkey before. And monkey seems, well, we'll learn more about this monkey because, yeah. Very, very, well, uncredited is very obviously Frank Welker doing the voice.
Is it really him or is it?
I watched Aladdin enough times to know that's Abu's voice.
I mean, he was working at the time, of course, so maybe, but I cannot say for sure that is Frank Welker. It does sound like him, though.
Yeah, so Indy kind of tells him, you know, that he's one of the best excavators in Egypt, and it's no wonder that that the Nazis are courting him to work on their dig site. And he's saying, they're courting everybody. My skill doesn't even matter. Anyone that can dig a hole is getting hired. Sala tells Indy that Belloc is in Egypt and he's working with the Nazis now.
And you know, you just knew Belloc was going to end up with the Nazis. You just knew it. Like, that kind of scummy dude. Yeah.
And, based on the burn that our Nazi guy had on his hand from touching the medallion, the Nazis have made some sort of replica to aid in their dig. But they're still not in the right place. Not yet. But
well, they're still digging. They might be in the right place, but they're still digging.
Yeah. So
we have...
Go ahead.
Yet another, it's kind of difficult to talk about the plot of this movie because so much of it is visual.
Yeah.
And the coming scene is possibly the most well-known action scene in the film.
Yeah, well, let's, apparently Marion has grown very fond of the monkey, even calling it her and Indy's child.
Yeah.
It's a very funny scene, but the monkey is not just a random monkey, as the monkey is a spy for the Nazis. We got a Nazi monkey.
Yeah, I'm so torn about this because
the monkey even does the salute.
Yeah, it's like. The monkey is like an accidental Nazi. It's a monkey. It doesn't understand. You know? Like, some human taught it to be a Nazi. Like, that. The monkey does not deserve that. Poor monkey.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is a Nazi monkey, and it kind of makes Marion kind of wander off in a different direction.
Yeah, so they're in Cairo. They're trying to figure out what their next plan is. And in an attempt to find the monkey, Marion is kidnapped.
And this leads to such a great chase and fight scene. Indy's
trying to fight these Egyptian men, these soldiers, these mercenaries or whatever they are, while also trying to keep Marion safe.
Yeah.
And Marion is no slouch. She does have some skills to defend herself. It's just that the first thing she was able to grab on was a frying pan while the other guy has a knife.
I mean, that can be a fair fight, depending on how good you are with a frying pan.
Well, she's able to trick the guy into following her into a house and then bang him on the head with the frying pan. That is a cast iron frying pan. Have you ever been hit with a cast iron frying pan? They hurt.
Speaking from experience, are we?
I can neither confirm nor deny this.
So, this contains, and we got to talk about it, one of the greatest moments in film history.
I love the story behind it. All right, yeah. So, let's kind of find out what Marion, she ends up hiding in a basket, and she's taken by the Nazis.
The monkey points it out. The monkey sits on top of the basket and is like, she is in here. So, bad Nazi monkey.
Bad Nazi monkey. Anyway, we have the infamous scene, probably the funniest scene in this entire movie, where this Egyptian mercenary with this big old scimitar is twirling it around and is ready for a big old sword fight. Indy is not having this. He looks tired as he's just been fighting all these other mercenaries. He just shoots the guy. Bang. Everyone's seen this scene. Even if you've never seen this movie, you've probably seen that one scene. And I love the story behind that scene. So apparently this was like one of the last days of them shooting the movie. And Harrison Ford, this is a story that Harrison Ford tells, is that Harrison Ford had gotten sick the night before. I don't remember what he got sick from, but he got sick.
And it was some sort of stomach issue that kept him in the Port John quite a bit, apparently.
Well, let's go with food poisoning, I guess, then.
Yeah.
So he's not feeling very well, and Spielberg choreographed this big fight scene, and he was all set to do it, and Harrison Ford is just too sick to remember the moves. Why didn't they just get a stuntman? I don't know. So he just says, well, why don't I just shoot the guy? My character has a gun, and then we can just move on with the story. Spielberg says, okay. And it led to the funniest scene in this movie and probably one of the most funniest scenes in cinema.
Yeah. I've heard Harrison Ford take credit for the idea. I've heard Spielberg take credit for the idea that Harrison Ford said, I just can't do like 8 hours of shooting a fight scene. And he said, there's no way I can make it shorter unless Indy just takes out his gun and shoots the guy. And apparently everybody laughed. And Spielberg was like, oh, well, maybe it's a comedy bit instead of another action scene.
And it works. It's one of the most hilarious scenes of this movie. Even though I knew the scene was coming, I still laughed out loud after it. It says,
I think it's because Harrison Ford, even sick as he was, has a really great exasperated face. And he uses it to such good... It's not just that Indy, like, is mad or badass or something and takes out a gun and shoots a guy. That's not it. It's just more like, ugh, this again. And then he just like casually takes out his gun and shoots the guy. Like, I do not have time for you.
And we kind of see this later in the movie with the big Nazi guy who wants to fist fight. Indy kind of slides up the paint and goes, okay, hold on a minute. Let me get into fighting position. Okay, let's fight. Like, he just...
Yeah, it's not that Indy... I think that's one of the things that people like about Indiana Jones is that he's not a superhero. He's a guy who is very competent at his job and can throw down in a fight, but he neither wants to fight, and he's honestly annoyed when he has to fight, and also he suffers injuries. And you know, also, like, after every fight, we see that he's beaten and bruised and, you know, tired and stuff. It's not like he just shakes it off and moves on.
Yeah, and he's, and we see it later in the movie, all these bumps and bruises and just, there's a lot of mileage on that body.
Yeah. It's so, not the years, it's the mileage.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite lines in the movie. Anyway, so we have another kind of comedic scene as Indy runs into this marketplace. And everyone has a barrel on, carrying all sorts of things. And so
Indy kind of topples out the assorted laundry of like half of Cairo in this scene. Yeah.
But eventually he starts to chase down what he believes to be the basket with Marion in it. They put her in this truck with explosives in it. Indy is able to shoot the driver, which tops the car over and... Boom. And Indy and us, the audience, is led to believe that Marion is dead.
And honestly, nobody seems as broken up about this as they probably should be.
Yeah.
Indy immediately is like, well, I killed the girl I violated as a teenager. Better get drunk.
I mean, get drunk is an acceptable response to seeing someone that you know die. But it's Sala's response.
Oh, yeah. Well. Sala has the worst response. Yeah, Sala's like, Indy's like, Marion is dead. And Sala's like, yep, unfortunate. Anyway, dinner? I kind of admire Sala's, like, philosophy on life where it's just like, oh, well, try to find the good in things. But, like, Sala, like, she just died, man. But Sala takes Indy to get the writing on the medallion deciphered.
So anyway, they're able to get out of there. The owner of the true owner of the monkey, this eye patch guy, is able to follow them thanks to the monkey telling where they are. And he pours his poison over these dates that they're eating in attempt to kill them. And we're back where you were saying, where they're getting the medallion looked at and translated. And there's something that they never knew about, as there's writing on both sides of the medallion. That apparently, when Mr. Nazi Man got his hand burned, he only had half the message burned on his hand.
Yeah, it gives a specific height for the staff that you have to put the medallion on to find the exact location of the Ark of the Covenant. But the other side says, yeah, but then make it a little shorter, you know, then it's like, we want to honor the god that, whatever. But, so without that, their staff is too tall. They are digging in the wrong place.
Mm-hmm. So they're in the same vicinity, but they're not in the exact area that they need to be.
Yeah, they're just at a slightly different part of the city that is being excavated. Meanwhile, Indy has this whole time been tossing a date up and down and has not eaten it yet. But the monkey's just been going to town. Monkey's like, hey, free plate of dates. Awesome. And right as Indy throws up the date to catch it in his mouth, Sala runs over and snatches it out of the air and points to dead Nazi monkey.
Dead Nazi monkey.
I mean, I feel bad for him that he got roped into it, but also Nazi monkey, so I don't feel bad as I should.
Yeah.
It's not like he was just a normal monkey. He was a collaborator.
Yeah. Anyway,
but so knowing that they've got the correct measurements, mm-hmm, and the correct medallion instead of just a replica.
Yeah, they go to the digging site where the Nazis are at. They are able to sneak in to where the map, apparently a miniature version of Cairo, is.
Yeah. And Sala, they have set up is is already, he's a digger, you know, like he already runs a crew and everything and had been on this dig site before. Mm-hmm. So he knows what he's doing and he's got guys who can help Indy, you know, excavate in the correct place as long as they can do. But first we got to get past all these Nazis.
And Indy almost never makes it out of that tomb with the miniature city, because Nazis kind of get to Sala saying, you're not supposed to be here. You're supposed to be somewhere else. And what's this rope doing here? And they kind of push him around, because according to the Nazis, he's just a digger and we're not digging in this area right now. You have to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And Indy is able to decipher with a little pocket translation of the hieroglyphs is able to find the correct point in the little temple here to put the staff, where to put it, and thanks to Sala knowing what time of day it is, the exact time to put the staff in, so the sunlight can hit it just enough to tell you exactly where to dig. And
the interesting thing is that the not only is the staff the incorrect height, but we know from looking at the image that they put it in the wrong hole. There are all these kind of holes on there, but the hieroglyphs tell you which one to use to place the staff in. And you see that the dust has been moved out of the way for a hole that's like 3 inches ahead of the one that Indy uses, mm-hmm. which is presumably where the Nazis put their staff. Mm-hmm. So not only is it the incorrect height, but it was in the incorrect place. So they are digging like in an entirely different section of the...
Yeah. And there's a nice scene. I mean, I won't say nice scene, but it's a nice little humorous scene where Sala throws this rope made of blankets and a Nazi flag.
Yeah, and Indy is like, what the crap is this?
What happened to the rope?
Yeah.
So they're able to get out of there. And in this scenario, as they're trying to get out of this little digging site, we find out that Marion is alive. That she did not die in the explosion. That they must have switched the baskets out. And Indy is at first going to save her, but then realizes if they get her out, it's going to cause more problems because now they're going to be all after them and they're not going to be able to get to dig the arc out. So, jerk move, Indy? Leaving her there?
Well, but... it is both a jerk move, but also the correct move.
Yeah.
He has correctly assessed the situation. She is upset because, of course, you're leaving her there with Nazis and that should never happen to anyone. But Indy is correct that she needs to distract them a little while longer because Indy and that entire crew of diggers that is with Sala have to go dig and find the structure that the Ark is actually in. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Which, that's going to take some time. You know, we need Marion to distract them.
It's a double-edged sword. So he had to make the judgment call. Granted, it doesn't make him look like a great guy, but yeah, it was the right call to make. So Andy's able to find the exact place thanks to the
correct staff of Ra.
Yeah, the correct staff of Ra. Thank you. And at the same time, his team, or Sala's team, starts digging in the right area. All this time, Belloc is kind of getting sweet on Marion.
Yeah, Belloc really has a thing for Marion.
Yeah.
He gets her a dress. He brings her wine from his family vineyard.
Yeah, he's trying to woo her and everything. And... we even, you know, once again meet our black-clothed Nazi man. And he actually shows us his seared hand with the image of the medallion on it. To kind of, if it wasn't
confirm
already...
that's where they got it from.
Yeah. Meanwhile, it's taken pretty much the entire day. But Sala's team has dug open the tomb where the Ark is. And, we can get the infamous line of the movie. Snakes. Why did it have to be snakes? As the entire floor is covered in snakes.
Here's what I want to know. The Ark has been buried for about 3,000 years, they said. Mm-hmm. I think that's maybe a bit long, but okay, sure, whatever. All right. This has been buried since the time of ancient Egypt. All right. Mm-hmm. They set up these snakes. We understand that these snakes are there as a protection measure because they left, places for the snakes to move between rooms and all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. There are thousands of snakes in here in the middle of the desert, where there aren't many people or wildlife. And even if there were wildlife, the wildlife is above them on the desert floor rather than buried under. What are these snakes? What have these snakes been eating for 3,000 years?
Each other?
To keep. I mean, it's like.
There is one click scene where one snake kind of nudges another snake and he starts snapping at him. So I assume the snakes have been eating each other.
My friend I was watching this with said, no, you don't understand. When they sealed this thing, the entire room was just floor to ceiling with snakes. And this is what's left after 3,000 years. This place was packed with snakes. So I don't know. Maybe that's... I mean, we see that they can, like, move around. So maybe there's a escape hatch somewhere underground where the snakes can get out and go hunting and bring back food. But I don't know. It seems weird to me.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Marion and Belloc, and we kind of get the callback as they're drinking this wine. And they're just drinking and drinking and drinking. And Marion pretends to be drunk and kind of tries to get Belloc to get even more drunk.
Yeah, she is getting Belloc as wasted as possible. And she has hidden a knife and she is trying to make him let his guard down. Because, like, hey, I'm even more drunk than you. Marion's very good at this game. And Belloc falls for it entirely.
Yep.
Unfortunately, her plan doesn't end up working correctly. Poor Marion.
Yeah, I mean, she tried, though.
Yeah, but, she makes the rookie mistake. She grabs the knife. You know, she finally reveals that she has a knife. She, you know, drops her drunken act. And she holds the knife on Belloc and starts to back out of the room while brandishing the knife. And Belloc just thinks this is funny because he's drunk. And she's like, well, I gotta go. See ya. And backs into the Nazi that we've been following, the one with burned hand taught or whatever.
Though I gotta
say... She makes the rookie mistake. Mm-hmm. You don't... like, grab a knife and then leave. You grab a knife and then stab.
Yeah.
And then leave.
Like, I think she played her hand a little too soon. That she could have easily hid the knife, like, behind her back and made some sort of gesture of, oh, hey, let's dance, and then stab them while they were dancing.
Yeah.
I mean, although, I gotta say...
soft and pierceable.
I gotta say, the black covered Nazi bringing out the nunchucks and turning them into a coat hanger is awesome.
That is one of the funniest scenes in the movie to me, because he pulls out this contraption and you're like, that is gonna be a Nazi torture device, and then it just turns out to be a coat hanger. And I love the reaction of Marion and Belloc, who both are like, ooh, some crap is about to go down, and then it's like, no, I just don't like to get my coat dirty. Like,
meanwhile, they found the Ark. Indy and Sala has found the Ark, and they're getting it out of the tomb. This golden casket box thing. We don't see it very much. I mean, we see it when they lifted it out, but it's mostly shown in shadow. And it's mostly, even for the rest of the movie, it's like in a crate. We don't really get a good look at it till like towards the end of the movie.
Well, yeah. There are a lot of stories surrounding the Ark. One of them is that, you know how Indy and Sala get the poles and they're lifting it up. That's not just for ease of transport. There are stories that touching the Ark at all, outside of very specific religious rituals inside of a temple, is instant death. There is a story that I remember, you know, being talked about in church a lot. It's a thing where, you know, they have it covered when the Nazis are moving it at the end of the movie. They've put a cover over it. And that is accurate to most biblical depictions, where they would cover it during transport. And it wasn't necessarily to protect the Ark. It was to protect the people around the Ark, because there is a story that apparently, like, the cover kind of came off of the Ark at one point, and a man that was carrying it tripped and fell and put his hand on the Ark and was immediately struck dead. So it was there to make sure you could never make physical contact with the Ark as well. So there are all of these ideas of, like, who can touch the Ark, when, in what circumstances, what prayers have to be said. You know, it's not just like it's a box that you can lift. So the fact that they're like, they keep encasing it in crates and they keep covering it with things and stuff is actually because, you know, you don't want to risk that.
Yeah, and as day breaks, our Nazi team sees a Solace team digging in the distance, and they are able to put two and two together and get their men over there, unbeknownst to Indian Sala. So they're getting up there, and as soon as Indy's about to go up, there's Belloc saying, "Hey, we got the Ark, and we're going to take it now, and we're going to lock you in the tomb. And maybe 1,000 years from now, when they find you, your corpse might be worth something."
Yeah. And also, we're going to throw Marion in here because Nazis.
Yeah, and that's something that Belloc is very angry about.
Because he's like, that was my woman.
Yeah. But he doesn't seem so bent out of shape about it. I mean, he's bothered by it, but it's like, oh, well, our love was never meant to be. Oh, well, goodbye. So, yeah, he doesn't like the fact that she got thrown in, but he's not going to mourn her either.
Yeah. Very, very shallow love, that.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we get the amazing famous scene of, you know, trying to keep the snakes away with the torches while figuring out how to get out of the tomb. An interesting thing I noticed. I watched this on Netflix, and when Indy falls into the tomb at the beginning, because Sala kind of drops the rope a little bit and Indy falls in, and he's confronted with that cobra,
mm-hmm.
There is a famous film gaffe that is known in that, where they had put, like, plexiglass or glass or something between the cobra and the other snakes and Harrison Ford.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, you don't want to risk your actor.
Mm-hmm.
So he is on one side of the glass. The snake is on the other, you know, reared up, ready to strike. And it's there to protect Harrison. But, of course, it's glass on film, so there is a reflection. And you can see the reflection of the snake in that scene. Except, no, you really can't. I looked for it, because I always look for that. Because it's always one of my favorite, trivia bits.
A few years ago, they remastered this entire movie for IMAX, and I assume that's what this version is.
Yeah, and I didn't get to see that, like, in theaters, because there isn't an IMAX theater near me. But the best I can figure is that in the remaster, they digitally removed that reflection.
Because George Lucas always editing these movies.
Yeah, which is annoying, because that was always one of the most fun, like, film goofs, you know? It's like, you look for the reflection of the snake. It's always like a little game I always played in the hundreds of times I have seen this film. So I kind of miss it now, but they've removed that apparently in the version that's on Netflix.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Probably, if you have it on Blu-ray, it's probably the same thing. Anyway, yeah, they are able, Indy is able to climb one of the idols in the tomb, knock it over, and break a wall open, and they're able to escape. Which is, again, works for them.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a couple of corpses in there, but that's to be expected. It's a tomb.
Yeah, it is indeed a tomb, so there are apparently screaming skeletons.
Yeah. That last bit of, you know, they're able to move a couple of the rock work out of the way and escape the tomb just as the Nazis are getting away.
Yeah, and they're able to find Sala and be like, hey, we're not dead. And Sala is thrilled. And he's like, by the way, they're putting it on a plane to fly it to Berlin. You need to stop them.
And I love how they're asking, hey, Andy, what are you going to do? I don't know. I'm making this up as I go along.
Yeah, it's also one of the best lines, but also kind of a summation of how Indy does things. Like, I'm just going to go to the place, see what's what, figure it out on the way.
One of the things, I mean, it's later in the movie, but I do, you know, when they put the Ark in the crate and they kind of put the Nazi symbol on the crate, but as we go on in the movie, it's like the Ark itself is burning that symbol off the crate.
Yeah, God hates Nazis.
Yes.
It's very, very obvious symbolism right there. God is like, nope.
If only more people realize that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, Indy is trying to stop the plane from taking off. He's attacking the pilot. He's fighting. And this is where we get big Nazi over here. This big, bald, giant Nazi who wants to fight as Indy is trying to climb on the plane. And yeah, the very exasperated look as he's trying to climb down the plane. He's telling Hogan, wait a minute, we'll fight. Yeah. I love that look that Indy just said, oh, all right, we got to do this. We're going to have to do this.
Yeah,
meanwhile, no one's paying attention to Marion as she's taking the
the stoppers. She's got the chocks out of the plane.
Yeah.
Out of the wheels.
I love Indy's. His first instinct is to do your shoes untied and then try to go for the kick to the nuts.
Yeah. I mean, you know, fair.
It doesn't work.
All is fair in love and fighting Nazis.
Yeah, but big Nazi over here knocks him down. Marion is able to hit, use the restraints on the Nazi pilot, knocking him out, but also forcing the hatch closed and her inside it as the plane starts moving. And yeah. In probably one of the best death scenes in this movie, Indy's able to duck, but big Nazi isn't able to and is decapitated by the propellers of the plane.
Yeah, it's a good scene. Marion spends most of this scene in the gunner hatch of the plane, firing the machine gun at Nazis who are trying to come to, like, you know, attack Indy.
Something tells me this was George Lucas trying to make up for not having Leia shoot in the Millennium Falcon.
Maybe. But she does end up shooting a lot of things, including a lot of fuel tanks, which distributes fuel all over the place. There's some fire setting fuel, and fires are gonna meet. She's trapped inside the plane. Help, help.
This scene recreated very faithfully in the Indiana Jones stunt show at Disney World.
Yeah, which I got to see, and it is, it was spectacular to see in person. I don't actually know if that one's still there, but it was. I got to see that show, and it was such a good show. They do a version of, the boulder run at the beginning. They do the plane scene with lots of pyrotechnics. There's a few other. Yeah,
it is still at Disney Hollywood Studios. Again,
it's such a good show.
Currently not running because a lot of their staff that do these kind of shows were let go.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Once we have a vaccine, if they bring the show back, I highly recommend it. It is one of my best memories of my last trip to Disney World.
Yeah. So yeah, the plane explodes. They're able to get the Ark onto a truck and get it out of there. Apparently, they're gonna just deliver it to Berlin on truck because they're Indy destroyed their plane.
Yeah.
And Indy is able to commandeer a horse and chase after them on horseback in this really cool scene.
This contains one of the greatest film stunts in history. Harrison Ford was doubled in all of the Indiana Jones movies by a man named Vic Armstrong. Vic Armstrong is legend at this point in the stunt scene. I believe he is still working as a coordinator, even though I don't think he actually does stunts anymore. Mm-hmm. Himself, because he is of a similar age to Harrison Ford. But his family, the Armstrong family, is still one of the foremost Hollywood stunt forces, I guess, working now. And his children, and I think some of his grandchildren and like their families and stuff, like it's a whole legacy that he's got going there. But he is the man that does all of the stunts for Indiana Jones in this scene. If it is not a close-up of Harrison Ford, you are seeing Vic Armstrong. He does the horse work. He does the climbing over the top of the truck and getting into it. He does the fall onto the front of the truck where he's hanging on to, you know, the grill on the front of the truck. And of course, he does the famous stunt where he goes under the truck and works his way down between the tires to the end and uses the whip to be dragged behind and pull himself back up to the truck. That is every bit of it is Vic Armstrong risking his life for that scene. And it's beautiful. It is beautiful.
For here, Indy is able to secure the truck with the Ark in it, even able to run off the Nazis off the road. And apparently Sala has taken this small town and convinced them to hide the truck, because as soon as he gets in there, he knows exactly where to go. He enters this little doorway, and as soon as he gets in, a bunch of these merchants shows up, sets up shop, and acting like they were there the whole way, selling their wares.
Again, I don't know how they could have planned for this, but it's a good funny moment nonetheless.
And then, you know, the Belloc and the Nazis get there, and there's nowhere this truck could have been. They can't see it, and yeah, it's gotten away.
But we've got to get the Ark back, you know, out of Cairo and back into America. So Sala sets up for Indy to ride with some pirates that he knows somehow, on some kind of smuggling ship that won't ask too many questions. Mm-hmm. And he's got his friend there who's the captain of the boat, and we get a nice scene on the boat with Marion trying to dress Indy's wounds. He's been shot in that last scene with the truck and everything. He's still beaten and bruised from fighting the large bald Nazi next to the airplane. And it's a nice scene of her kind of, you know, cleaning his wounds, and they get a little romantic, and, you know.
Unfortunately, Indy kind of falls asleep before things can really get started.
However, it is suggested that he woke up and more things happened in the cutaway, because she is wearing a nightgown when he falls asleep, and when they wake up, she is wearing nothing.
Yeah. There's a nice little funny scene where she's trying to clean the mirror and accidentally knocks an Indy in the face with it.
That scream is hilarious.
And she is completely oblivious to the fact of what she's done. Because it's a double-sided mirror, full size, you know, person size, and one size dirty, so she tries to flip it over and just knocks right into Indy's face while he's trying to dress his own wounds. Yeah. Can't catch a break. And that's probably why he fell asleep. He got knocked.
Yeah, he's probably got a concussion.
But not enough that, you know, he's not able to have a moment.
Yeah.
This is also where the scene where he's on the boat where the power of God burns the Nazi logo right off the crate.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, so yeah, they have their moment. They wake up and they've had a night together. And the Nazis have had a submarine and they've taken over the pirate ship.
Yeah.
And are getting, getting the Ark. And they've taken Marion again.
Yeah, Indy tries to get to Marion in time to hide her, but the Nazis are just a little too quick, and they take Marion, and Indy has to hide. He successfully hides, but they do take Marion.
Credit to the captain, who acts like a complete a-hole, saying that they're going to use the woman for their own desires just to leave her behind. If you're just
Say they're going to sell her into slavery.
Yes,
what
but,
they say. I mean, not in so many words, but that is the implication.
But it's really just a way to protect her, to keep her out of the Nazis' hands. But if you're just not really paying much attention to the movie, it's going to come off really, really bad.
Well, yeah, and...
Because they straight up say, we've killed Indiana Jones and we're going to take his woman. So it's obvious that they're lying to protect them both. Because the captain is
friends with Nazis believe that they've killed Indy. Mm-hmm. But they're going to take Marion anyway, because again, she is the daughter of the man who knows everything about this. So it is understandable that the Nazis aren't just being jerk Nazis here. That they actually
believe her. I think it's more the fact that Belloc just wants her.
Well, it's the lead Nazi that says we're going to take her. And I think that's more in a bit of racism. Like, how dare this black man try to set terms with me. I'm going to show him who's boss. So I think it's kind of just the you know, inherent white supremacy of the Nazis that kind of messes that up. Probably another group would have probably just taken the deal just to be done with it. But the Nazi has to like be like, no, I am better than you, black man. That it's the time that Belloc says, hey, can I have her as part of my payment? And you can have her back if she doesn't please me. And the Nazi's like, yeah, I didn't really want the woman anyway. Just go ahead and take her.
And this is really just a distraction as Indy ends up on the Nazi sub while the pirates are cheering Indy on.
Yeah, another thing I've always wanted to know is how does Indy get inside the submarine before it submerges for the trip?
Movie magic.
I mean, come on. There's like probably just the one hatch, and it probably leads down into Nazi Central. So
we never actually see the submarine submerge.
Yeah, but like you don't just travel the ocean in an unsubmerged submarine. It creates drag. I mean, they're meant to travel under the water. It travels faster that way.
We'll ask Spielberg. If anyone knows Steven Spielberg.
Dude, if anyone knows Steven Spielberg, you're my best friend. Hook me up.
But we do see that Indy is completely soaked, so I assume at some point he, you know, unless he can hold his breath for a long time.
Yeah, so, I'm not sure how long it takes a submarine to get from, you know, Cairo to the Aegean Sea, but it's probably a little bit longer than you can hold your breath.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we end up on some little island somewhere that the Nazis have a base on, you know, somewhere in the Aegean.
Also Indy kind of takes a page out of Han Solo's book, takes out a Nazi and puts his uniform on.
Unfortunately, it doesn't fit, so he has to knock out a second Nazi.
Yeah, aren't you a little small for a Nazi?
Yeah. So he at least is able to just kind of run around the base, not saying anything and looking like he belongs there, which is a smart move. Meanwhile, the Belloc has convinced the Nazis to set up a ceremony to open the Ark, because like I said, there are a lot of prescriptions on when and how and exactly the manner and who can be present when the arc is open and everything. It's and honestly, honestly, except for the fact that it that there is a warning on the medallion to never disturb the arc or open the arc or whatever, this movie doesn't really get into why it is so dangerous for random people to touch or open the arc. But all of this is in Jewish and Christian scripture about about this power that the Ark has to kill people who don't treat it respectfully.
And the Nazis themselves are kind of getting annoyed by it, because, like, why do we have to do this Jewish ceremony? And this things have to be done a certain way.
And Belloc convinces them, you want to open it here, because if you get it all the way to Berlin and you open it and there's nothing inside, Hitler's going to be really mad, and it's going to be you that has to pay for that. So they go along with it because, like, well, yeah.
Yes, and Indy tries, aiming a bazooka at them.
Belloc says, go ahead and blow it up. I know you won't do it. You actually care about history and, you know, research and stuff. Belloc just wants the money, but he knows that Indy actually cares about the value of the object to history.
Yeah.
The thing is that Indy falls for it and takes the rocket launcher down off his shoulder and is captured. But the thing is like, you don't have to aim it at the Ark. There's like 30 Nazis standing there in clumps near-ish the Ark. You could have just, you know, fired a rocket at a group of Nazis and taken your chances to run. I would have done that.
Yeah. So they go to where they need to go to open the arc. They set up lights. They set up a camera. So apparently they're going to film this opening.
Well, remember, Nazi propaganda was absolutely obsessed with filming great moments in the Reich. So I can buy that.
And they performed a ceremony to open the arc. And yeah, they open the arc, and here comes the lights that's coming out of it. Smoke comes out of it. Light comes out of it. Indy instantly tells Marion to shut their eyes, to not look upon the arc at all. And,
I love the way this is set up, because at first they open the arc and there's nothing inside but sand. Mm-hmm. And everybody kind of looks around, and you see Belloc have that, like, uh-oh. You know, like, I've delivered to the Nazis a box of sand, and Hitler is going to murder us all. But then, as the lights start to swirl and stuff, Belloc is like, yes, it worked. And then all these beautiful, like, angelic kind of figures are there, and Belloc is like, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. You know, he is so stoked.
And then things go south when the angels change their faces. It's very scary-looking faces. I don't want to say demonic. Yeah, kind
of skeletal faces and all. It's a face of death. You know, unless the angels were hiding from humans, to see an angel in the old text was a moment of terror for most people. Like, they were supposed to be a thing that if you looked upon them, it was actually kind of scary.
The ain't one most
because
people,
they are so not of this earth. It's something so far out of your understanding.
What most people consider to be angels be people with they look like people. They have the wings and the halos and stuff. That's not exactly the biblical description of what an angel is.
Yeah, and a lot of the descriptions are things that are so unearthly that just to see it just breaks your brain. So they kind of went in a sort of medium, you know, a meshing of that, where that it starts off as like a beautiful humanoid kind of thing, and then it turns into something that is absolutely terrifying as it uses the power of God or whatever to destroy these people that were trying to profane the Ark.
Yeah, and this, I just love that the lights, the yellow light that comes out of it is, first thing it does, it just takes out all the Nazis. All the Nazi soldiers, they have it, the light goes right through them and they're all dead. Even the camera, the camera's destroyed.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like I said, God hates Nazis.
Yeah. And but the ringleaders of the group are the ones who are saved the most horrible deaths.
How many memes have, how many times have you seen the melting faces of these guys as memes online?
Yeah, but honestly, it's kind of an effect that still holds up. Like, the way they were able to build the wax heads and then melt them on screen and then speed up the footage and, you know, it really is a good effect. So the two Nazis get their face melted. Belloc, who is not only profaning the Ark, but also profaning the ceremony. He is dressed in the robes of a Jewish priest. He is speaking, you know, ritualistic words, accepting a place that isn't his to take, you know?
Yeah, he just, they guess he just explodes.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that first kind of the pillar of fire from heaven consumes him. So he seems to be in pain from that. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, I guess God is also a scanner because his head explodes just like scanners.
And then we get that's sort of a cliche now. We get the big hole in the sky and the beam going to it.
Yeah, it's like, you know, the angels are kind of like, well, here you go. This is what we've done. I'm assuming they were angels. I can't think of anything else they would have been. And the Ark kind of closes itself.
So, I do want to pause at this point. All right. So, you've seen the show The Big Bang Theory, right?
Of course.
Okay. So, there's an episode where Sheldon is showing Amy Raiders of the Lost Ark for the first time. She's never seen the movie. So she sees the movie and they have this conversation about it. And Amy brings up a good point, is that regardless of what Indiana Jones had done in this movie, the movie would have ended the same way. Because the Nazis would have opened the Ark. Everything that happened would have happened exactly the way it happened, whether or not Indy had gotten involved or not.
Yeah,
Marion might be dead, but, you know.
The only thing that would have been different about what happens to the Ark is the final kind of resting place, if you want to say that, of the Ark. Mm-hmm. Like, where the physical Ark ends up after the opening is all on Indy. But what happens when the Ark is open was always going to happen. And the interesting thing is that if he hadn't interfered, and if Belloc hadn't interfered, they would have probably taken it straight to Berlin, opened it in front of Hitler, and wiped Hitler out in, like, 1936.
Yeah, so World War II wouldn't have happened, and then we wouldn't have Captain America.
Yeah, and so it's like, it might have been a better ending if Indiana Jones hadn't gotten involved.
But, the light of God was also able to burn off the ropes that was keeping Indy and Marion tied up. And again, since they did not gaze upon the Ark as it was opened, they were spared.
Yeah.
Fast forward, we go to Washington, because there's a Washington Monument. And Indy is wondering what's going to happen to the Ark now that it's in American hands. And we get that line. It's being taken care of by top men. Who? Top men.
Men. Yeah, another part of this movie that is parodied constantly.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is that this sets up the idea that is later confirmed in the movie that people don't like to talk about, that this warehouse is full of mystical objects of power.
This is, yeah, the United States, at least according to this movie, has a warehouse filled with religious objects or objects of great power that
magical objects, yeah, extraterrestrial technology
that they don't plan on ever using because they likely cannot use them or everyone will die.
I mean, I don't know. I don't really think that's the way the American government works, but okay, sure.
Sure, Spielberg.
Yeah. This film is also kind of part America F yeah propaganda. Yeah. I mean, this whole series kind of is.
Considering that this came out in the middle of the Cold War.
Yeah, and also, you know, there is a bit of, you know, pride at a Jewish man making sure that Nazis get punched as often as possible on screen. Mm. Which I support, you know.
And the final scene of this movie with the boxes, that itself has been parodied to death in every medium.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's pretty much almost every scene in this movie has been parodied somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in the wrap up.
In the wrap up here. This is a great movie, and I can see why so many people love this movie and how it is seen as one of the greatest movies of all time. And it started the Indiana Jones franchise. A franchise that has expanded not just to movies. There was a TV show. There was the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. Video games. Like I said, there's rides. There's Indiana
novels.
Jones rides. Novels.
There are quite a bit of Indiana Jones tie-in fiction, especially for young Indiana Jones. There are a lot of young Indiana Jones novelizations.
I mean, rides at Disneyland, the stunt show at Disney World. This is just, this whole franchise just has survived to this day. And like I said, Disney has been talking about doing another Indiana Jones film with Harrison Ford. We don't know when this is coming out, if it ever does. I mean, I know Harrison Ford has been on board with it. I don't know how much else you can do with the character without a recast and going back to him being younger. Which a lot of people, if they didn't like the fact that Han Solo got recasted for the Solo movie, I don't think people are going to like Indiana Jones getting recasted.
You know what? There are going to be certain people that are going to hate anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's just some people that you can't please. Most people I know found something good in the Solo film, you know. Oh. It's just there's a minority who's very loud. And I think that's what we see here. I did kind of want to say a couple of things just about it in closing. One of the funniest things to me is that I didn't actually realize that the guy at the beginning of the movie, Satipo, mm-hmm, actually had a name. Because if I remember correctly, Indy only says it once, and that's like as he says like goodbye to him, you mm-hmm know, like to his corpse. And what he says is adios, Satipo. But Harrison Ford sometimes has a problem with diction and enunciation. Mm-hmm. And for my entire life, I thought that the final thing he says to the guy is adios, stupido. Like that he was calling him an idiot for like running off without him and trying to stab him in the back. And I always thought like, man, Indy, that was cold, you know?
Well, in a way, he's kind of right, because, again, the only way he was able to get past the booby traps the first time was because of Indy. And now that he left Indy behind, he just fell victim to the first booby trap.
Yeah, I mean, across. Of course. It makes sense, and that's why I never questioned it for years. But it was just that I don't think I knew that that character ever had a name other than, like, you know, Guide or something. I always thought he was saying adios, stupido. The other thing is that Indiana Jones is one of my cosplays that I do.
Mm-hmm. I think I've seen you in it, yeah.
Yeah. And there is a lot in this film especially where we are introduced to the silhouette of Indiana Jones. You know, him being silhouetted against the setting sun in Cairo. Marion seeing him first as a shadow on her wall and realizing who it is because of the distinctive, you know, hat and all that. We see him kind of in shadow when he uses the whip at the beginning of the movie when we first get our first shot of him. Mm-hmm. And everything. So there's a lot made on that silhouette. And the first time I put on that costume, I was going to some party at nighttime, and I left the party and walked outside and ended up like under a street lamp or something. And I looked down and saw this giant shadow with that silhouette, and I got goosebumps from my own shadow. Because that silhouette is so impressive and so such a cultural icon that even when it's you wearing the costume, it is such a visual, you know, a striking visual to see that shadow in silhouette.
Yeah.
So I love it, and I love every time I wear that costume. It's just awesome.
So I don't think we really need to ask the question, but we're going to ask it anyway. Does this movie have the magic? I'm going to say absolutely.
Yes, of course, of course. That was never a question.
Yeah, if you haven't seen this movie at all, or if you haven't seen it in a while, it's on Netflix. Go check it out. All three movies of Indiana Jones are on there, and the one I don't talk about, the one I don't acknowledge.
And also, the Young Indiana Jones series was not that bad. It was.
Remember the Young Indiana Jones series, and I would love if that put on Disney Plus.
Yeah, but if you can find that, you know, bootlegged somewhere, more power to you. But if you ever get to see any of that, it's really good.
The Young Indiana Jones series is that they made the effort to make it not just an action show for kids, but have the educational element of him finding these historical items and teaching about the actual culture that those objects are a part of.
Yeah, it was a good show and a good idea that I wish had lasted longer. It deserved mm-hmm. deserved better than it got at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, great movie. We might do the other two good ones at some point.
At some point.
But this has been such a fun ride for our 1 year anniversary.
Yeah, we never thought we'd get this far again. If you've been sticking with us this whole time, thank you. We very much appreciate it. And we'll see what we go through year two of this podcast.
Yeah, cross your fingers. Hopefully we'll be recording again on this day next year.
Yeah. So let's move on to what we're doing next week. Next week is another anniversary that we're going to be celebrating. And that is the 10-year anniversary of the movie Tangled. It's amazing that this movie's been out 10 years.
Yeah, it really does not feel like that long.
Yeah, we just passed the 10-year anniversary last year of The Princess and the Frog. So now we go through another princess movie in this, which means that we're only a handful of years away from the 10-year anniversary of Frozen.
Oh, goodness. Wow.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're going to start off our year two with a rather interesting film for Disney.
Yeah, a movie about a girl in quarantine in a world called Corona. That has no relevance to 2020.
Nope, but you know what? We got to make the joke before the year is over. So come yep. back next week to hear us make more jokes about that.
So again, thank you all for indulging us for the last year. We appreciate it. And come back next week for Tangled. Go see Indiana Jones if you haven't already. And we will talk to you all next time. Bye.
Bye. Don't let the magic stop here.
Join our conversation online on Facebook at Rewatching the Magic.
Twitter at Rewatch the Magic.
And of course, new episodes every week at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com.
Remember, the magic is for everyone.
It only stops if you let it.